A little bit of review. Let me spend about 5 minutes. So we're using the same terms here. You know, I'm thinking it's really nice to be able to teach in shorts. Sleeveless shirt. I think at St. Olaf, some of our buildings aren't air conditioned. It would be really wonderful if starting in September I could just come on. Anyway, for the sake of everybody's similar definitions, let's just differentiate briefly HIV and AIDS. HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus believed by most people in the world to be the culprit that causes AIDS. It is a human virus, not an animal virus, though it has some similar relatives in the animal kingdom. AIDS is the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I like to emphasize that it's a syndrome. It's not one particular disease, so that we don't make assumptions about those who have AIDS having certain symptoms or illnesses. It's a spectrum of maybe 15 or more different diseases that folks who have AIDS could have. At any one time, when we hear numbers of people with AIDS, we need to multiply by 4 to 10 times that the number of people with HIV anywhere in the world. It's difficult to know how many people are infected for fairly obvious reasons. A lot of people don't know that they even have the virus. A lot of people don't come forth and just talk about it. So experts estimate anywhere from 4 to 10 times the number of people with AIDS have HIV. And that's important, I think, because people all too often in the lay community and even in the press tend to interchange the two terms, and they're not interchangeable. Then I've mentioned earlier in the week the spectrum of HIV illness, and I just wanted to put that on the board for tonight, briefly mention it. A lot of you are familiar with the old picture that used to come out about HIV and AIDS, the pyramid picture. A lot of you heard about it. And AIDS is really the tip of the iceberg, and underneath the water are all the people who have HIV at various stages of illness. The center stage used to be referred to as ARC, or AIDS-related complex. That's not used anymore by the medical community. They've decided, whoever they are, CDC primarily, I think, that the spectrum of illness made more sense, so that we talk about people who are initially infected with HIV. Within about 7 to 10 days, people who have been infected with HIV experience some acute illness that lasts a week, maybe 2 weeks, sometimes longer, generally with symptoms of some nausea, maybe some vomiting, lack of appetite, difficulty sleeping, things that you and I have about 3-4 times a year, generally speaking. Sort of a flu-like illness is how it's explained. Goes away, people assume they're fine. So that is rarely a key for people to worry, because it's a very common kind of illness that they experience. Then can come a period of asymptomatic HIV illness, a long period of time for many people without any symptoms related to HIV. This is the area people worry most about, being infectious to others without knowing, because you don't know necessarily that you're sick. As we talked about earlier in the week, the average length of time is getting longer and longer if people are asymptomatic, 8 to 10 years for well-nourished, healthy, otherwise healthy white people in the Western world. It can be that long. For women, sometimes, for people of color, that could be less long for a number of socioeconomic and other health-related reasons. Then comes a period of symptomatic HIV illness without being full-blown AIDS. This can be a whole range of symptoms, from dramatic weight loss to night sweats, constant dry cough that lasts for a long time, some nausea, perhaps some beginning dementia, although it's difficult often to detect. And then comes full-blown AIDS, diagnosed because a person has HIV plus one of the illnesses that the CDC lists as an AIDS-related illness. Does that make sense? What's important about it, and I think the reason we moved from this pyramid picture, is that there are a lot of people in this country in this category who are sicker than people in this category. A lot of people with symptomatic HIV illness who can't work and can hardly function. A lot of people with AIDS have had pneumocystis, perhaps, and been treated, and they're out of the hospital, they're fine, they're back at work, feel great. So it's not been fair in some ways to say, well, these are the people we need to be worried about, or they're the sickest. And maybe people think this way makes more sense. I don't know, you can tell me how it works for you visually. Okay, comments about that or questions? All right, let me just continue. We're going to talk a little about transmission when I get a little further on, and talking about the gay community in particular. But the reason I wanted tonight to spend some particular time on the gay community and the impact of HIV/AIDS is this is the community that was initially the hardest hit in this country and in most of the Western industrialized, developed, whatever word we want to use, nations. And I think despite the fact that their percentage, that the proportion of people with AIDS in this country who are gay or bisexual men is declining, and we're going to talk about that, it's still very critical that we keep in mind how this epidemic has affected these communities. I'm going to talk both about gay men and lesbians, although gay men have been most dramatically hit. I'll talk about some of the reasons for that. But it's important to also include lesbians because of the connection between them and gay men in this country and in other places in the world. A lot of you have been attending Dan Spencer's series this week, too, and I hope a lot of you have been doing some thinking about your own beliefs about homosexuality, because though I tend as a teacher to try to separate AIDS and homosexuality so that we don't all run around saying, well, it's the problem of the gay men, it is intimately tied, and tonight I want to intimately tie them, and how we view personally homosexuality will color a great deal how we view people with AIDS in general, and certainly gay men with AIDS. So I encourage us to think about that. If, for example, we believe that people do not choose a homosexual orientation and that they're an oppressed population, then generally speaking, we may be more understanding of or at least less judgmental of the kind of behavior that has allowed HIV to spread fairly quickly among the gay community. If, however, we believe people choose to be gay, we may despise the behavior they exhibit and blame them for the epidemic. Or some of us may fall somewhere in between there. But I think it's real important that we spend some time each individually thinking about that. Let me talk primarily a little bit about the incidence of AIDS in the gay community. Now again, mostly this is AIDS, not HIV, because we have numbers of people with AIDS in this country. We don't have accurate numbers about people with HIV. But this is just to demonstrate how the epidemic has changed proportionally in this country. This is hard to see in red or pink, I'm sorry, but let me just read it. In Minnesota, for instance, in 1987, among people with AIDS, 88% of them had the risk factor of having sex, men having sex with men. This is now how the CDC is classifying this, male-to-male sex, or men having sex with men, instead of the term homosexuality or bisexuality, because that's a little difficult to distinguish sometimes when we're talking about risk factor. 88% of Minnesotans with AIDS in 1987 had the risk factor of men having sex with men. In 1992, it's 80% of the people with AIDS in Minnesota are men having sex with men. For HIV in Minnesota, the known HIV cases, it's 62% men having sex with men. So that in the next few years in Minnesota, the number of AIDS persons who have gotten HIV by male-to-male sex is dropping quite dramatically. Similarly, in the United States as a whole, 1988, 68% of the people with AIDS were at risk because of male-to-male sex. 1992, 58%. So it is dropping. Some of you saw my pie chart earlier in the week of the people who have AIDS in this country. A little over half, or 58%, have as their sole risk factor male-to-male sex. That is not to say let's worry less about them then, but that is to say that there are other communities being more dramatically affected now over time and that the trends are a little bit different. But I think it's important to point that out. What it does ignore, these statistics, is the rise in transmission rates in young adolescent males who are homosexual. This is primarily studies that are based on the older homosexual population, like ages 35 to 55, who have been most dramatically hit were the ones who were younger when it first hit the coast particularly, and that the other large cities with large gay populations. So as we talk about adolescence tomorrow, and we'll talk a little about gay adolescence, there's a major worry and concern about the increase in the epidemic there. Okay, let me talk a little about transmission of HIV in the gay community. We've talked earlier in the week about the three primary modes of transmission of HIV being sexual activity, sharing of body fluids with somebody who's HIV positive, or sharing a needles a needle with somebody who is HIV positive, generally in IV drug use. And third, mother to child. Now, the first two are very important with the gay community. Primarily, HIV is spread in the gay community by oral or anal sex. Primarily anal. It's a very efficient way to transfer HIV because when sex is in the rectum, it's easy to tear the tissue and there's a clear direct connection to the bloodstream. So male-to-male anal sex is a very easy way to transmit. And that's what often has happened. People ask about, well, oral sex for men and men or men and women. Stomach acid kills the virus, but often in oral sex we're not aware of what happens, that there can be small cuts in the mouth, or that people even say for safer sex don't floss beforehand because of bleeding. And it's those kinds of small cuts that maybe we're generally unaware of that make oral sex for any of us a risk, but it is to be talked about as a potential risk. Certainly gay men are IV drug users, many of them. Not all of them, but we sometimes ignore that part of the statistic. And I think we need to talk about that as certainly a transmission possibility. Certainly gay men received blood transfusions before 1985. So that's an option. So we need to say it isn't just gay male sex that transmits HIV among gay men. However, that is the primary mode. In the lesbian community, I even had, when I talked with the minors earlier this week, which by the way, in case anybody's interested, went very well, there were about 15 to 20 of them. I had them anonymously write down as they came in their questions about HIV or AIDS so they wouldn't have to ask in front of their friends. About half of them said, I don't have any questions. I said, okay, then why don't you write down a question you think your friend might have? And this was a quite astute group. I was quite impressed. Partly self-selected, I think, who, first of all, who come to Holden, second of all, who come to Holden, then come to an HIV talk. But they asked fairly high-level questions, one of them being, can women give it to women? Do lesbian women get HIV/AIDS? It's extremely rare, but it has been found to be the case. Many lesbian women have been upset at the lack of effort to educate their own communities about this risk of transmission. Obviously, vaginal fluid is infectious, and if women don't take some precaution, there can be exchange of vaginal fluid in women-to-women sex. So there have been more and more efforts now within the lesbian community to try to prevent that kind of transmission. But that also, I think, needs to be mentioned. Within the gay community, too, it's important to at least talk about bisexuality sort of as we go along. There's a lot of discussion, I think, about the spectrum of sexuality and sexual orientation. Some people believe that there isn't any such thing as bisexuality, that really it's men who say they're bisexual are just not quite accepting the fact that they're homosexual. Other men who I know well say, no, I'm clearly attracted to both sexes and I'm right in the middle, I know that exactly where I stand. The issue about it with HIV is that often those folks are married or do have relationships with people from both sexes and often are not as honest and upfront with themselves or each other as they need to be to avoid transmitting HIV. It's a very high risk in places like Minnesota. We have lots of calls to our Minnesota AIDS Project hotline from housewives in the suburbs, frankly, who identify themselves that way and say, my husband has told me that he's had some liaisons or relationships with men outside of my marriage, and I'm absolutely devastated and shocked, and I don't know what to do. So it is not uncommon. Certainly isn't as there aren't as many people who claim that they're bisexual as are gay in this community, in our community, but it is also important to be talking about. What's important there is that the behavior is what's risky, not the orientation, and I can't say that enough. It's the behavior that's risky in communities of color. It's not that they're people of color. It's behaviors that put women at risk. It's not because they're women. So all along this week and all along your thinking about HIV/AIDS, think about behaviors and not groups and not types of people. That's important to remember. Okay, just a couple more minutes. I want to talk about some of the categories of impact for gay men with HIV and the communities of which they're a part. And I want to just talk primarily about the differences for gay men than for other people with HIV and AIDS. Because a lot of the ways that people are affected by this virus and this syndrome are very common across genders, across classes, across countries. So today I just want to focus more specifically on the gay community. In terms of the physical or sort of medical arena, for many gay men, and I'm aware that this can be a generalization, but many of the gay men I knew took very great pride in their athletic ability, their strength, and their body image. Many of us take great pride in our athletic ability to walk up to Copper Basin or Heart Lake, or for me today, Prego as I am, Honeymoon Heights. And if we can't any longer hike up to Honeymoon Heights or run around Lake of the Isles three times without getting winded, it causes great difficulty for us. And many, many gay men who have AIDS have a great deal of difficulty adjusting to the difference in their body weight. Men like the man in our case study we used last week for suicide, who had Kaposi's sarcoma, lesions all over his face and his body, didn't want to go in public anymore. He quit going to mass because he was so ashamed of and embarrassed about the way he felt and looked. So body image is very difficult. That certainly translates into how a person relates within a relationship. And it's real easy for those of us who don't think we're at risk to talk about having safer sex. Well, those people should have safer sex. Most people who have HIV or AIDS don't want to have sex anymore, ever. Either their sex drive is reduced because of being ill, which happens to many of us when we're sick, or the fear of transmitting this virus somewhere else is so strong that they really retreat from having any relationship. Or the question becomes, how do I tell my current partner or a future partner that I am HIV positive? So there are a lot of adjustments. When I think about asking any one of you to change your current sexual behavior, which gets quite patterned if you're like me, the thought of that can be quite dramatic. If somebody said to you, as of today, you have to do things very differently. You have to wear a condom and use spermicide every single time, or you have to learn other ways of expressing your sexuality besides intercourse. Many of us would get quite uncomfortable and take a long time to adjust to that. Same is true for gay men. In the social arena, I've seen a lot of stories. I have seen a lot of situations happen. Generally speaking, within families or friends who are deemed to be family in the gay community, there can be a reaction of shunning or rallying around that person. I'm pleased to say, and I look for any hopeful piece of this epidemic anywhere, that my experience generally has been that family and friends have rallied around folks with HIV and AIDS. Part of that is we're in Minnesota. We're not as devastated as places like the Bronx or Chicago or LA, where resources are just depleting. Generally, I've been very impressed with what families have been able to do and willing to do. It obviously depends on the situation. We talked briefly yesterday about how many communities of color find themselves not wanting to talk about the homosexuality of their loved one, but they still rally around and do the care and until death, if need be. One thing that people don't think about a lot is the isolation that can happen for people with HIV and AIDS. I had a man I think about frequently as a patient in our clinic who had AIDS and had to retire from teaching school, but he felt pretty good most of the time. And he sat home all day long with a dog he had while his housemate and lover went to work. And he said, all my friends work, and I'm home all day long, and I have nothing to do, and I feel useless and worthless. And this was at the time when people with AIDS were starting to live longer. So they were asking me the questions about, well, now what do I do with my life? I thought I'd be dead by now, and I feel pretty good. We connected him with an organization in Minneapolis that finds volunteer opportunities for people, and he walked to a nursing home two blocks from his house, which he could do, with his dog one time a day, and walked around with the residents, and they pet the dog, and he just felt infinitely better about doing something very small, at least, or he thought it was small. But to be home alone all day, when any of you are sort of sick, but not so sick that you have to stay in bed, it's kind of dull. So these folks are getting a little bored sometimes when I was working with them. In the psychological arena, there are lots of issues that come out. First one I want to differentiate, and some of you are as familiar or more familiar with this than I am, but it's difficult in people with AIDS often to understand whether they're undergoing one of three things: delirium, depression, or dementia. It's true with many people. Elderly people, sometimes it's difficult to determine, is this a delirium, which is generally a reaction to a medication or a treatment of some sort that makes people's minds not work as clearly? Or depression, which any of us would have if we had AIDS, it makes perfect sense, which can sometimes cause our concentration to lapse and us not to think as clearly and our judgment not to be as good. Or dementia, which is an organic decline in the brain functioning, primarily memory, similar to Alzheimer's, that affects many people with HIV and more as they're living longer. So it takes a trained mental health person, either a neuropsychologist or a psychiatrist or some well-trained physicians, to try to differentiate what's happening there, which is important in order to know how to treat and care for that person as a family member or as a professional. So that's one important point. The other is that the coming out process for people with HIV or AIDS who are gay men is often referred to as the double whammy, because many times those folks have not told certain people in their lives, particularly maybe biological family members, that they're gay, and now they have to come out and say, I am gay and I have AIDS or HIV infection. I don't think, unless we've gone through that ourselves, we can really understand the dramatic impact that has psychologically. What happens with a lot of gay men with AIDS is that process has to be rushed. They were going to take their time and feel right about, when is the time to tell my mother or my sister or my daughter that I'm gay? And that process is sometimes rushed if all of a sudden somebody has one of the AIDS-related illnesses and the doctor says, you know, you're not doing that well. And then that person has to decide, do I tell now? Am I ready to tell now? So often we need mental health professionals to help us do that. The third, in the psychological area, is another impact that I don't think any of us, unless perhaps we were survivors of Hiroshima, can understand, and that is the dramatic grieving that goes on in the gay community. If one of us thinks about losing a wife, and then a second wife, and then three of our best friends, and then 6 or 10 or 15 acquaintances, and maybe a partner in business, to the same disease, can we grasp the multiplier effect of the grief in these communities? I have only a window of vision about that with people sharing with me. I don't even know what to do. I didn't get over the first one. And then it happened 3 months later, and then 3 years later, and then now again two more. And that's continuing, and that will continue for the foreseeable future, people who have been infected during the 80s and into the 90s now. So it's real crucial that we remember that and try to be empathetic about that. Spiritually, folks with HIV or AIDS in the gay community experience sometimes a loss and sometimes a gain of great hope. Sort of depends on where they are and where they have been in their relationship with God or their understanding of a greater other. I always found it very important to ask people about their spirituality and use that term instead of their religion or their religiosity. Many gay men have been separated from the organized church for clear reasons that Dan is talking about and that many of us are aware of. And sometimes the time of diagnosis with AIDS or with HIV is a time to say, will the church and or God take me back or accept me or love me or be there for me? And I've worked with men with AIDS who have done a whole range of work with that. Some people saying, is there a priest I can talk with? And thankfully there are priests that people can talk with. There are ministers that people can talk with in all denominations, at least in Minnesota. We're fortunate with that. But it brings up the common question for any of us hit with any life-threatening disease, which is, why me? Why now? Why here? What's going to happen? What does this mean about my life? What did I do or not do? Can I be forgiven? Can I be loved? Can I be redeemed? Will I be with God? So lots of those questions come up. Not different from most of us, except that most of us at that time are not necessarily alienated from the church home that has been part of our lives, maybe, since we were born. I think I'm going to skip over some of the economic issues, although we can talk about it if it comes up. I think the biggest one is that, similar to any people with AIDS, a lot of gay men with AIDS lose their jobs. They're not able to keep them anymore for reasons of illness or subtle sort of pushing out by employers, although that's illegal. And lots of difficulty trying to get life insurance. In some parts of the country, you can't even get life insurance. If there's anything on your application that even hints at maybe being gay, like you're a hairdresser or you're an interior designer. There's amazing discrimination on the basis of occupation that's also illegal but done, that really, especially in the age of AIDS, is making insurance companies quite nervous, and they're watching. And I've had experience with that are really sort of overwhelming. I think I'll just mention, lastly, in the legal arena, the issues of wills and living wills. Primarily the concern that comes up for gay men is that more and more over time it is getting better, but there are many places in the country where hospitals or nursing homes or home care agencies or whoever it might be will not accept the word of a long-term gay partner as the word that makes sense for what this person would want. So you have a man, gay man with AIDS dementia, perhaps, and he has not spoken with his family nor they with him for 15 years, and he's been with a partner for 12 of those. And it's often the case that partner is not recognized as a spokesperson for that person with AIDS. So it's been very critical in the gay community to intervene right away when people are HIV positive and say, these are your rights, and these are the things you can do to protect your rights in this particular state. Now, it's changing sort of nationally. And the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 does protect people with AIDS from discrimination. But we don't have any national law that protects people from discrimination based on sexual orientation. So there are ways sort of to get around it. And if you have HIV in sort of early stage, it can be real difficult to get sort of your rights protected. Our hospital was the only private hospital in Minneapolis who would accept a designation of a gay partner as a healthcare, what's the word? Power of attorney for healthcare decision making. It was not written into our law as legal, but nowhere was it illegal. So we said, we're going to go with that until somebody challenges us, and nobody did. And now we have a living will law that says whoever you designate is your person. And it's important that people know that those laws have changed, and in some states like Minnesota, very recently. Okay, about two more minutes here. The response of the gay community to HIV and AIDS has been quite dramatic in two areas. One is the aim at the risk reduction and self-care in their own communities. Somebody mentioned the other day that we have seen some studies, albeit studies in certain parts of the country, generally San Francisco and New York and LA, and studies of older gay men. Nevertheless, important studies that show a very dramatically reduced incidence of transmission of HIV as a result of massive AIDS education in places where gay men are, gay bars, bathhouses before they were closed, whatever gay social groups, perhaps, gay churches. So that the education component has been very strong and very powerful in this country. I mentioned briefly that has not hit so clearly the younger gay population. Part of that, I suspect, is their developmental stage, which is to say, I'm not a risk for anything, not HIV. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that they sort of see, at least the studies are showing, that younger gay men in their teens and early 20s sort of say, well, that was their issue. They were fast and loose and easy, and I'm not really that. I only have a few partners, and while I'm safe most of the time, I don't always use a condom, but most of the time. So we see some real risky behavior in some of the younger men. The other dramatic response of the gay community was and continues to be in terms of care for themselves and each other. The very first organizations in the world to care for people with AIDS and HIV were the Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York City, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which was called the Kaposi Sarcoma something before that, and in London, the Terence Higgins Trust. Those three have been really the leaders in educational materials, in support groups, in establishing one-to-one buddy programs, in doing home-delivered meals. It's been outstanding. I will say, as a dramatic testimony to that, that when we look at comparisons of cost for people with AIDS for 1 year, San Francisco is dramatically less than New York City. Part of that, if any of you have ever read Randy Schultz's book and The Band Played On, and if you haven't, I urge you to read it. It's really a story of the epidemic in the gay community in this country. is that the New York City gay community was not organized, except for the gay men's health crisis. Generally speaking, they didn't want to acknowledge HIV and AIDS because a lot of gay men were in high positions of power in the government and weren't active and out and open. Unlike San Francisco, which for many years has been an open and accepting place for gay and lesbian people, many active, open gay people in the government. As a result, the city and the county and the state of California committed a great deal of funds early on to support these grassroots community-based programs. So people in San Francisco 3-4 years ago stayed an average of 11 days in the hospital with AIDS. In New York City, they stayed an average of 40 days. Now you tell me, would you rather put money into home care, which is less expensive and more helpful, more humane, like in San Francisco, or into the hospitals, which are highly expensive in New York City? In San Francisco, there was only need for one nursing home to care for people with AIDS because there's so much home care, and the Visiting Nurse Association of San Francisco does an incredible job caring with people. In New York City, they couldn't find a nursing home who would take anyone with AIDS, and they all stayed in the hospital because they had no place else to go. And that includes babies, and that isn't just gay men. The point being, however, it's the gay community, lesbian women, gay men, who are taking the initiative. Many people around the country, though, are telling me that that initiative is being sapped dramatically, partly because a number of the early leaders in the gay community who had AIDS or HIV themselves have died or are too sick to be doing more. Many of the lesbian women who took on a lot of the caregiving responsibilities early are burned out. They can't keep doing it. So we need to consider as a community who's going to pick up the slack as those folks are really wearing out as this epidemic drags on. And they do not only care for their own. They don't say, we only want gay men who have AIDS. They're caring for everybody, and they're in the forefront and doing far more than the general community in some of those cities. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there so we can get to our case study so everybody can cool off, including me. Any comments? It's so hot in here. I know, it's just awful. Like Minnesota. I left Minnesota. Yeah. Questions or comments about this thus far? Okay, otherwise, what I'd like to do is first get 6 volunteers to sit in these 6 chairs. I could just take the 6 people right here. It's a very easy task. It's just to read something. Would you be willing to do that? Okay, why don't you be William? You can be Judy. Cross genders here. Jim. You'll be Elizabeth. You'll be Steve. And you'll be Susan. Take a minute to look over those while I pass these around. What I'd like you to do is get in groups. This has to be fairly rigidly 6. Try to get in a group of 6 if you would. And I'm going to pass this case study out. And then we're going to have our volunteers read it aloud while you read it. And then I'll give you a further instruction. Try to do 6 if you can. Oops, upstairs. How many folks do you have? You're going to do a group or are you just going to sit there? Look at this. All right. How are you doing? 6? Eric and you are just together.
Nobody wants us.
That's okay. You two want to turn around. Oh, okay. One of them, why don't you turn around, Lori? And both of you come here. There we go. Okay. Let me just say, this case study is credited to Mike Lemming, who is a sociology professor at St. Olaf College. He's given me permission to use it on various occasions with different groups. So he wrote it, and I'll give him credit for it. The point of this case study is to get us to examine some of our own attitudes that connect homosexuality and HIV/AIDS. What I'm going to do is read the introduction so the tape can hear it, and then I'm going to ask our 6 to each take a role and just read it aloud so the tape has it on tape and you get a chance to hear it. What I want you to be thinking about as you hear it and read it is who you agree with. Because the first step is going to be to ask you to list from 1 to 6 who you most agree with to who you least agree with. Yeah?
We don't have anything.
Oh, can somebody share one who has a live nerd? Oh, hey, you guys got it. Everybody has one here. Did you just have 2? Okay, thank you for sharing. That's what I say to Rachel, thank you for sharing. Okay, I'll come back to the instructions, so everybody just listen. I'll read the introduction here. Millie Johnson, a 54-year-old mother of three, receives a letter from her 25-year-old divorced son who lives in Metropolis, USA. In this letter, she discovers for the first time that her son is gay. After a stormy divorce, which ended a marriage of 4 years and produced 2 children, Bill has shared an apartment for the last year with a male roommate who is a physical therapist at St. Stephen's Hospital. As Millie continues to read her son's letter, she encounters more information which devastates her entire life. Bill has AIDS and probably has at most 11 months to live. What is she to do? With which proposed course of action do you most identify? Okay, can you read those?
Okay, I'm reading the part of William Johnson, Millie's husband. I've always done my best to be a good parent. As my oldest son, Bill, in many ways, is an extension of myself. I love him dearly, and I'm nearly destroyed by this recent news. However, I can't compromise my own values and principles. Bill is an adult and has chosen a lifestyle that I cannot accept. He knew that AIDS was a possible outcome when he decided to become involved in a homosexual relationship. Now he must live with this consequence. Millie and I have responsibilities to provide for and protect the safety of our other children.
Judy Johnson, Millie's 20-year-old daughter. Right or wrong, Bill is still my brother. Our family has to rally around Bill and allow him to come home and die. If Mom were to quit her job at Olson's department store and I were to drop out of college for a year, at least we could make Bill's final days happy. We have an obligation to Bill, and even if it requires us all to make some sacrifices, we cannot turn our backs on him when he needs us most.
Jim Johnson, Millie's 18-year-old son. I love my brother and wish that all of this news were not true, even though I suspect for years that Bill was gay. Yet as a Christian, I feel that Bill is paying the price for his sin. This is God's judgment on his homosexual behavior and his failure to keep the vows he made to Susan and her children. I will try to communicate to Jim his needs for God's forgiveness. Even if he should die an early death, if he is truly repent, God will provide him with an eternal life in heaven.
Elizabeth Wiseman, a dietitian at St. Stephen's Hospital. Bill and I have been co-workers in food service at St. Stephen's for the past 8 years. While I like Bill, I'm concerned for the reputation of our hospital and the safety of our patients. I think that Bill should be given a leave of absence or else put into a paper-pushing job within the hospital. St. Stephen's has an obligation to protect all of us and the patients we serve.
I'm Steve Sundquist, Bill's roommate and lover. I have an unconditional love for Bill. Unlike his family, I feel that I know Bill's needs as a gay male. Furthermore, as a healthcare professional, I have the contacts and knowledge to provide the proper environment for Bill's final days. If he should return to his family at this time, they would only lay a guilt trip on him. While they care for Bill, they cannot possibly understand the complex person Bill has become. I wish that they would leave us alone and give Bill the opportunity to die with some dignity and affirmation.
Susan Johnson, who is Bill's ex-wife. My relationship with Bill during the past year and a half has been rocky at best. Even though Bill told me he was gay, I promised not to bring out the issue in the divorce proceedings. In exchange, Bill did not challenge my desire for the custody of our children and agreed to generous child support payments. Bill's homosexuality has hurt me deeply. I still feel that I have been deceived by him, had been deceived by him for 6 years. Yet I do care for Bill and always will. However, I feel that I have an obligation to protect my children from Bill and Steve's relationship and from the remote possibility of catching the AIDS virus. Therefore, I have requested that the children not stay overnight at Bill's apartment and that Bill and Steve restrain themselves in expressing their affection for each other. Bill and I have jointly told the children that he is dying from cancer. When the children are older, I will tell them the truth and give them a letter that Bill has written explaining his feelings. Meanwhile, I can only pray that the remaining time they have together will only leave the children with good memories of their father.
Okay, one additional piece of information is that Bill is also a physical therapist. That's left out of here. I'd like you to take 2 minutes quietly and think, who do you most agree with? And sort of mentally put a number one by that person through number six. Who do you least agree with? Take about 2 minutes to do that. And who you as a group most agree with to who you least agree with. And I would ask one of you, if you could, to keep track of it. I have one pen. We have a couple markers here. So talk about it. Be able to discuss why it is in your group you most as a group agree. Who needs a pen? Somebody? And this will be for about 10 minutes if the tape wants to turn off. I'd like to ask each group who you chose for number one and who you chose for number six first, okay? And then we'll get some time for discussion. This group, number one is...
Steve. And we came to that consensus very quickly, and we have died from there.
Okay. Can you name a six? Okay, we'll come back to you.
No, we got a six.
We did get a six. Voting is not consensus. Okay, we'll come back to you. Number one?
The lover.
Steve. Okay, and number six?
Jim Johnson, brother.
Jim. Okay. How about upstairs? Number six is William. Okay, and number one? Okay. Back in the corner.
Number one is Steve.
Okay.
And number six is Jim.
Oh, sorry. Hello. Thank you.
That's right.
One, okay.
That's right.
Yeah, it's over here. And six is Jim, you said?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. That's great. Now, the rest of you who didn't come to some consensus, what was part of the issue for you? How come it was difficult? Who's willing to talk about it? This group wanted to do one and then all sixes. Not all. Just some of them. Sorry, I need to generalize it all.
It's too easy to split into a little, splitting a hair on one person, you know, took a lot of time.
Maybe on one thing somebody said out of the whole paragraph might turn you a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Okay. How about others of you that had trouble coming?
Well, we eventually came to consensus, but it was real hard knowing what the person who aids himself wanted. Did he want to be at home, or did he want to be with his lover?
Well, and that's pretty clear to me what came out here, is that one of the initial values you all are coming to is the sense of autonomy. This person has the right to decide where he wants to be, and no one asked him. Did they? Nobody asked him. We all jumped in. We all assumed we know best. In the first case study that Mike wrote, Elizabeth was not another person at the hospital, but was his doctor, and said, he needs to stay in this city because I know how to take care of him. Those small town doctors don't know how to take care of him. So there was an additional sort of paternalism on the part of a female physician, which is very interesting. I think he changed this because of the healthcare issue of a person being a physical therapist, probably. Okay, other comments about why it was difficult to come to any consensus? Now, interesting that across the groups, you came to some consensus. Now, I would say something about Holden Village. The kind of people that come to Holden Village. Is that accurate? Now, that's not to say you're all the same. It is to say, generally speaking, you're thinking along some similar lines. Yeah.
Assuming that they're talking about bringing the son home where the father and mother and everybody's there.
Right. They've all quit their jobs
then
in school.
Then the sister is absolutely the worst one, because she must know that there's such a polarized feeling in that family. There's no way there's going to be any love in that family.
She is creating a major crisis.
She is going to bring him into an environment where he cannot receive any love.
So she's the one that needs the help.
She needs the help.
Okay. Yeah. How about you?
We had problems dealing with whether the impact of the person on the life of this guy. And what they said, that there are some, in some cases, what the person said was so bad because of the one who said it, and what the person who said may be dumb, but because they wouldn't have much to do with the eventual solution, it wasn't that damaging.
Okay, so perhaps the lack of information there, or we also don't have much information about who has what kind of relationship with Bill.
So for Judy, I was originally willing to put a number one for her, because I thought she was saying what she thought should be. In the best of all possible worlds, he should come home to a loving family. Now, the reality of the situation might be totally different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what she said and what would happen if they did what she wanted
are two different things.
Yeah.
How about anybody upstairs? Comment on how... Yeah.
I would think he might really want his family to come to an understanding.
and to have peace with him. And so even though it would be very painful for the whole people, the whole grouping, for him particularly, knowing my own family, I think that we need to work on it.
And we have an indication there from him, though slight, in that he wrote a letter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, many people don't even get that far. They get AIDS, they die of AIDS, and family never knows about it. And this man, Bill, was taking some little step about, I at least want you to know, we don't know if the letter ended with, please let me know what you all think you want to do for me, or you all think I should do. But he did make a step, yeah. Any final...
Judy, the sister, didn't rule out the lover getting involved at home.
So as with any case study, somebody working with his family would say, we need more information now.
We don't know how far apart they live.
Yeah, and they don't live probably real far apart, but we don't know that. It could be quite a long ways away, true. Okay, I'm sorry we've run out of time, but it leaves you with lots of questions and maybe some fertile discussion topic for the next couple, 3 days. Thank you for your attention in a warm room, and see you at this.